because we are living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical.
Good afternoon, and welcome to Chemical World. I am Kenna Crampton, membership director here at KDNK, and I've got my co-host here with me,
Maggie Seldine, peer recovery coach at Mind Springs Health. Always happy to be here with you, Kenna.
And I'm always happy to be here with you as well.
We just wanted to quickly make a note that this is November 10th, but we have pre-recorded this episode, so we have no knowledge of what has happened in the election, so we will not be addressing that at all today.
Yeah. I voted today. I'm really excited about putting my ballot in the slot. It just feels good to vote.
Yeah, I voted by mail, and I also am, like, registered through some weird channels that I got an email telling me that Garfield County received my ballot. So that was really cool. Can't argue with that.
Cool. All right. So we're going to go ahead, Maggie, and explain where we're going to go today.
Yeah. You know, I think that Chemical World has been getting a little free form, and I like that, having it a little more conversation based. But I did think we could start today by kind of talking about some of the data that has been coming out recently. Of course, this cannot necessarily influence your election process anymore, but, you know, it's still really important to look at how substance abuse and just, you know, the negative consequences of the opioid epidemic in general have definitely been increasing. COVID-19 has definitely exacerbated a lot of these issues. But, you know, really, 2019 was another really bad year, record high overdose deaths in Colorado. And the Colorado Health Institute recently released a report that is all about 2019 data. And it's saying that there are quite a few Coloradans who are in need of substance abuse treatment and are not reaching out. And I'm looking at this graph right now. That's really sad to me, because one of the number one reasons people aren't looking or aren't seeking treatment is because of stigma. They're worried that providers aren't going to treat them with respect. They are worried about judgment from, you know, providers, and also from family members. They're worried that other people in their life, their loved ones, their employers, people like that might find out about their substance use. And the number of Coloradans who reported stigma as the reason that they did not seek needed treatment services significantly increased between 2017 and 2019. It went from 41.3% of people did not feel comfortable talking with health professionals about personal problems in 2017, and that increased to 72.8% in 2019. And kind of the same data for concerned that somebody would find out that they had this substance abuse issue, it increased from 43.9% in 2017 to 72.4% in 2019. So my point here is that even pre-COVID, we're actually seeing an increase in people feeling like they're going to be stigmatized for seeking behavioral health services.
Wow, that's really interesting. I know that, and we've kind of even talked about this. We talked about this, I think, in like the first episode where you were talking about meth addicts and what your brain goes to when you think about meth addicts, and then but what your lived experience is with meth addicts. And I just it's interesting to me how much that, like, I don't feel like I judge people for being in recovery. I don't feel like I'm like that, but no matter what, I always am struggling with being open about where I'm at. And, like, for example, when I first started working here at KDNK, there was a point when I needed to be late for work because I was going to go to a therapist appointment, and I was nervous about saying why I was going to be late for work. And I finally had to say, like, it's not that big of a deal. I can just tell them I have a therapy appointment. Like, why was I thinking so much about it? Like, what should I tell them? You know, should I just say a doctor's appointment? Should I just say, like, I'm just going to be late for whatever reason? Like, just tell them I've got a therapy appointment. And And even talking about a friend of mine who killed himself, and actually we just had the anniversary of him committing suicide, and I was talking about him to one of my coworkers, and I just said, he passed away about 10 years ago, and I got nervous about saying that he killed himself. And it's interesting to me just how deep that shame and stigma is planted, that I don't feel like I'm judgmental, but at the same time, I have to convince myself that it's okay to be open about me seeking help, about me being in recovery, about friends of mine. It's not shameful to say that he killed himself. That's the truth. It's the honest truth. He struggled with a depression or whatever it was that pushed him to that point. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And I don't need to feel ashamed or worried that I'm tainting his memory by saying that. That's how he died.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up so many good points there. You know, we're all influenced by our culture, by our families, by our peers, in a lot of ways that we may not realize. You know, for example, I have friends who are in AA, and they don't necessarily go to AA a lot or really even believe in a lot, you know, because it's all about take what you like and leave the rest. And yet then when I talk to them about things like medication-assisted treatment, which used to be called opioid replacement therapy or treatment, you know, they're all up in arms, like, that's not sober. And it's like, well, where are you getting this? Because this isn't, I would never expect this from you, but it's like they've been in AA for so long. And I see things like that all the time. And there's lots of different kinds of stigmas too. And that's something that I thought was really valuable that you pointed out, because it's like there's stigma of substance users, right? From the general community. We don't want our family and friends and employers to find out that we drink every morning or that we're, you know, using pills in the afternoon or whatever it is we're doing. And yet there's also stigma about being in recovery, and there's stigma about being sober. And God, this is, I was just thinking about this the other day. So I've been asked to share my recovery story with a group in December, and so many things, like, how do I get this down to 10 minutes, right? And I was thinking about this time that I wasn't actually trying to necessarily be 100% abstinent, but I was partaking in Sober October, which just ended and is celebrated every year all over the world. It's not anything formal. I heard about it for the first time 6 or 7 years ago. And, you know, you just try to be sober all through October. And I did that a couple of times before getting completely sober. But I remember being at this party, and I won't even identify my relationship with this person. I'll just say this person I know could not understand or accept that I was not drinking, and was going out of their way to do some really shady things to try to get me to drink. Like, oh, can you just hold this beer for me for a minute while I go do this? And like repeatedly asking me like why. And of course they're drinking. And, you know, if you have ever had a conversation with somebody who is really intoxicated, they tend to like, or somebody who has long-term opiate abuse, they tend to repeat themselves a lot. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, she just keeps asking, like, she couldn't, like, it could not register in her brain. And she was really putting a lot of shame. You know, it's a good thing I don't have a lot of respect for that person in the first place. Like, if that was somebody close to me trying to do that. And I think that that is a huge thing that, you know, restricts people from getting into recovery, is that thought, like, I'm going to lose all my friends, or my family's not going to talk to me.
Totally. There was one point when I you know, like I had said, I messed around with also taking a month off or whatever before I decided to go into recovery. But there was a point when I'd gone about 40 days without drinking, and we were going to this wedding, and it was a destination wedding, and it was going to be like 9 days long. And I had decided before I went to the wedding, and I had discussed this with a girl that I knew who was in AA, and we talked about, like, is it safer for me to try and stay sober at this wedding where nobody else is going to be sober, or is it safer for me to just partake and not try and put myself through something that's going to be very, very stressful, and in the end, I'm not going to be able to stay sober. And whatever, we talked about it, and I ended up drinking at the wedding at the entire time, doing lots of stuff. But there was one point when I remember my husband and I were about to get on the elevator, and there's a whole group of people from the wedding, and we both had beers or drinks in our hand, and everyone in the elevator was like, "Oh yeah, we heard you guys were sober. Like, how lame. I'm so happy you guys are drinking now." Yeah. And da 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 da, and just like really made us feel bad about deciding to be sober for the amount of time that we had been before that. And then, you know, just making it just really, it felt really bad. Felt really bad.
And how frustrating is that? Like, yeah, we all know it's lame to quit drinking. And it's not, you know, and like it can, like life, in my opinion, is more fun. It's like as somebody who is abusing drugs and alcohol pretty much my entire, you know, cognizant life, like being sober is its own high. And I can enjoy life better. I can enjoy the fun things more. And I'll also say that now, and not everyone is comfortable with this, and I really respect that. But now when I go to parties where people are drinking, I feel like I really fly under the radar. And I'm like, nobody's going to remember anything I did or said because they're all drinking.
Totally. And you end up remembering the party and remembering the conversations mm-hmm. you had and not regretting the things that you said. That was a really big one for me, like waking up in the morning and not regretting all of the conversations that I had. And I realized too, talking to people who party but don't necessarily have like substance abuse issues, that they just don't understand how drinking and doing drugs really isn't, and it's not fun for people who abuse them. Like your goal is to have fun. That's the goal of drinking 12 beers in one night. The goal is to have fun. But I don't know anyone who has 12 beers and actually has a good time, you know, because you're either so wasted that you can't stand up or speak, or you're so wasted that you're crying and you're upset about whatever, or yelling or beating someone up. I mean, anyone I know that actually does drink 12 beers in one night, like, they're just generally not happy people anyway, but
yeah, unless they're like Andre the Giant and they need that much alcohol. Yeah, and I think that that's another great point, is like just that lack of understanding. Like, you can't have empathy, you know, without understanding. And I think that that is what's so hard with addiction and substance abuse. And addiction, you know, somebody asked me the other day what I think about like addictions to cell phones. And it's like, well, it's kind of like I was saying a little while ago on an episode about the big A, little A addiction. It's like, well, if that's the way your brain is reacting to this stimulation, whether it's a phone or gambling or sex or shopping, then yes, it is addiction. But we also don't want to undermine the seriousness of addiction by throwing that word around just because somebody spends a lot of time on their phone or spends a lot of time shopping, because there is a difference between, you know, just retail therapy and a real addiction. But I wanted to say, too, that I was actually watching a film just this morning where somebody was saying, even though I have been through it, I still don't understand addiction. I still don't understand how, you know, it can become the number one priority in life. And that is, I think, a huge part of where the stigma in our culture comes from, is a lack of understanding. And the, you know, general theme in our culture has been, this is a moral failing of the person. The person is to blame. And there's been a lot of, you know, shifts and changes in how we viewed addiction as a culture. But we're really, for the first time ever, as a general public, moving away from that moral model and understanding it as the chronic brain disease that it is. And the treatment recidivism rates for alcoholism or drug addiction are very similar to treatment recidivism rates for other chronic diseases like diabetes or high blood pressure. And so when we see it like that in the data, and when we can see these brain scans of, you know, normal functioning brains and things like that, that technology has really allowed us to show the public something that providers have actually been trying to say for a really long time, and that this is not a moral failing of the person. This is a disease that the person has no control over, but that recovery is possible, and that brains can actually not only improve, but like overcome and be rewired the same way that we rewired our brain into addiction by, using substances through hard work. I'm not saying it's easy. Through hard work, we can rewire our brains back to somewhat normal, quote unquote normal, because I don't really like that word. I'm sorry I'm using it, but more healthy functioning.
Yeah. Yeah, I appreciate you mentioning or emphasizing that it is really hard work. It's really, really hard work, but it's so fulfilling. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, that's just the way life is. Things, whatever you have to work hard for is always fulfilling when it's over. And it not over, because also it's never really over. Right. It's just like the grief of losing someone really close to you, whether it's a parent or a kid or a friend, like that grief, it never stops. It gets easier to deal with, along with, I'm hoping that one day it's easier to start rewiring my brain. No.
Well, and I don't want to create false hope there, because I think it takes like upwards of like 10 or more years, you know. But one study that I always really fall back on, too, is just this woman or young girl, actually, who had anxiety, and she practiced meditation for 10 minutes a day. And even if she was actually ruminating during that time and not being mindful, her brain literally improved in 8 weeks from just that 10 minutes a day. And I don't know if you're familiar with like the Buddhist monks, like their brain waves are different because of that time that they spend in mindfulness meditation than our brain waves. And yeah, there is no quick, easy fix. Nothing in life that's worth doing is easy. And it is worth it because, yeah, you can go to the cousin's wedding and be like, I didn't make a fool of myself and like embarrass myself in front of my whole family or, you know, whatever. Like it is worth it for sure. And I think one thing that you and I always talk about a lot is like we can drive places. I actually still, everywhere I go, I am still paranoid all the time that I'm going to get pulled over for a DUI. I haven't had a drink in over 18 months, and I'm still paranoid every time I drive that I'm going to get a DUI. But in reality, I don't have to worry about that anymore, which is great. But yeah, I mean, we all thought as a society that OxyContin was an easy fix, and it just doesn't work that way. There's no magic bullet.
Yeah, I worried at one point that my honesty about how hard it can be with someone ended up pushing them away, because I was having a really hard day when they reached out to me. And I was having a really hard day. And I was like, you know, it's great. Sobriety is wonderful. But you got to really want it and you got to really work for it, because it's a lot of work. And of course, now I worry that that was maybe not the right thing to say, but I am always one to just be as honest as possible, because I never want to give people false hope, like you said. And not even with that, just honesty in general. Like I said, I would beat myself up about like, should I be as honest as possible about going to therapy, or, you know, and I'm still beating myself up for not being honest with my coworker about how my friend died. Because I like being honest, and I think that that's a big part of recovery too, is just being as honest as possible about what you're feeling and where you're at in life. But anyway, that's hard work.
Yeah, and I think that that is a huge theme of this show, and what we're trying to do here is that by talking about these things and by talking about our loved ones that we've lost to suicide and by talking about our struggles with substance abuse and addiction, we open up the doors to those conversations. And every time we're out there saying, I'm a person in recovery, or, you know, saying these scary words, you know, like, I'm a person living with borderline personality disorder. I've lost a lot of people to suicide. But every time we say these things, it reduces the stigma associated with it and hopefully makes it more approachable for people to get the help they need. And with that, I'm going to kind of circle back around to some more data. So according to Dr. Rob Valick, who's the executive director of the Colorado Consortium for Prescription Drug Abuse Prevention, and also somebody who I really commonly like to throw his studies out there. So according to him, right now we have about a 68% treatment gap in Colorado. And what that means is that for every 10 people who would like to get treatment for substance abuse, say enter a residential program, only three people will be able to do so. And these are the people who are out there actively seeking treatment. And that's not counting the 95,000 Coloradans in 2019 who stated that they needed care and didn't get it. This is indicative of a lack of treatment and service options, specifically in our rural communities. And just, you know, that stigma, it is so hard. Like, it's hard to get help even if you want it. And so something I really wanted to touch on today is just that as a behavioral health professional, I am really excited to witness these shifts away from this moral addiction model and towards this biological disease model in our practitioners here in the Valley. And it's really exciting to see more and more people becoming aware of this. And this is, I mean, part of my job is to educate providers because, you know, people who went to college 20 years ago, their heart's in the right place, but they just might not know the science that's out there right now and the evidence-based models that exist. So as far as stigma goes, I really just want, as a reason that people do not access treatment, I just want to say that that is going away, that there is a lot of great education happening, and that there are some really amazing providers all across the country and here in Colorado and here in the Roaring Fork Valley that are working to provide non-judgmental, compassionate care to people with substance abuse and alcohol issues. Another one of the primary reasons that has been identified as a major barrier to people trying to seek substance abuse treatment is that they're concerned that insurance isn't going to cover their treatment. And so I wanted to address that one, as well as Mind Springs Health and Mountain Family Health Centers are both indigent healthcare providers. They both accept Medicaid, Medicare, and will also work with patients who have no insurance or are underinsured. And so if that is a concern of yours, that you think that they're not going to pay, or if stigma is a concern of yours, you can reach out to me at 970-531-5060. Or there's a number of peers, and the role of the peer is to advocate for you when that stigma does get in the way and to be your partner in treatment and make sure that you get treated with the respect and dignity that you deserve if for some reason you're not getting that. And also to connect you with treatments that meet your income level and your personal needs. And so as far as insurance, stigma, peers can help you connect with the right services. And if you're one of those folks who is interested in accessing treatment for a substance use disorder but are concerned that your insurance won't cover it or that you don't have any insurance or funds to cover it, medication-assisted treatment is covered by Medicaid. And there are also funds available for anyone who's uninsured seeking medication-assisted treatment as well. So there's a lot of Medicaid providers, sliding scale providers out there for medication-assisted treatment. And we've had a lot of great new bills and legislation get passed this year in response to the opioid epidemic and substance abuse issues in general. So beginning January 1st of 2021, Medicaid will also cover inpatient treatment and some medical withdrawal services, so some detox services as well. And again, there is funding that exists if you're uninsured and are looking to access this. And specifically, there's some new funding coming out for individuals who are interested in living in recovery homes. We don't have really any in the Valley, but Oxford House is a big one, and we have them all across the state. And these new funds in January will cover the first month for free for individuals who have some history of opioid or stimulant use. It doesn't necessarily have to be your primary drug of choice, but that is under the state opioid response grant. So lots of current and new options in 2021 to get your substance abuse treatment covered by Medicaid or some of this grant funding.
And that I love that peer model, because it just I respect is such an important aspect of life, and I think in relationships, and I think that is the one thing that we can point at that is why people feel so much shame and stigma, because they feel no respect when they mention that they are someone who's in recovery or an addict or still actively using, or that drunk person at the bar who's always wasted and just annoying and nobody wants to talk to them or deal with them or whatever. It's no, they don't get treated with respect. And I know from experience that when you don't get treated with respect from other people, you stop respecting yourself. And that's why you start using, because you have no respect for yourself, no respect for your body. You don't care what happens. It's like what I was saying in the last episode. I said so many times, I don't care if I die like my dad, because I didn't have any respect for myself. Mm-hmm. And I know that from revisiting a lot of what I went through just as a young kid with going through school and being that kid that people don't expect a lot out of, and they kind of expect you to be a mess up, you just start to think of that as yourself. You start to think of yourself that way. And like, I'm not going anywhere anyway, so why would I try any harder in school? And that stuck with me up until just in my mid-20s when I finally was like, oh, I want to read a book. And I hadn't that thought had never crossed my mind, the wanting to read a book, never, because it was so, well, why would I read? I don't have to. I'm not going to school. Why would I, you know, it's just no respect for my brain, for anything. And that's where I think it all starts, is, you know, when you treat people with respect.
Absolutely. And that piece about expectations is so important. And it reminds me of a study that was conducted where I'll just give you the long short of it, that basically these scientists said, we gave all the students at this elementary school a test, and this group, they're going to excel. They're going to really go far academically in the next year. They're going to have this big academic like growth spurt kind of intellectually, right? So a year later, they come back, they check out the kids, and lo and behold, that group has really excelled. But the twist is, there was never any test done in the beginning. There was never any difference between that group of students. But because the teachers had this expectation, the students never knew any of this. It was only the teachers. So the teachers had these expectations. And that same story manifests itself in every classroom in America every single day, whether it's because you have minority students or impoverished students or students that come in, you know. And how lame is that, that you have a student that's clearly wearing dirty clothes and unkempt, that it's their fault? And I actually talk to my clients about this all the time, because it's the way that our system turns us into criminals, because we don't have the supports. And God bless every teacher out there. Like, they need to be making a lot more money. They need to have a lot more supports. Like, what are we going to do with our 300 new residents in Pickin County schools? Where are the 30 new teachers for those students? Where are their houses? Where are their salaries? You know, it's pretty unfair to me that people can afford to just, oh, we're just going to move to Pickin County because we're over the city. We don't have the teachers. We don't have the capacity. Anyway, get off that tangent. But, you know, it's like, it goes like this. You have a kid with ADHD. He's automatically pigeonholed as somebody who's not going to be able to learn. He gets put in special classes. He becomes this problem child. He's constantly getting into trouble. And the problem is that there's no one there to support him. And he's being made into this bad guy. 20 years later, he's been in prison for 10 years on drug charges or whatever. And it's like, this was the life that our system gave him. This was not who this person had to be. And it happens to all of us. And yeah, as far as the peer piece goes, the power of the peer is just so impressive. And, you know, for me as a peer recovery coach, I've been there. I have been in a behavioral health setting seeking crisis services because I just did not know what was going to happen that day if I didn't. And being stigmatized, being judged, being criticized, being patronized, feeling like I was just taking up their time that could be better used with other people, feeling like I was not an agent of my own health care, you know, being treated like I could not possibly be taking care of my own, you know, needs. And I had to fight actually pretty hard to finally get the therapy that I wanted. And I was really lucky I found somebody I really liked, but it was a fight. And again, it's like goes back to that treatment gap of people who are trying to get help and can't. And that's only the ones who are trying. Like, I do not expect every person at rock bottom to be able or willing to fight as hard as I did for that treatment. But that's what I can offer as a peer, is I know that frustration and I know that pain. And now I kind of know the system a little bit. But another story I just wanted to share that relates to that as far as the power of the peer is after that experience. So I spent about 4 hours in a behavioral health office because I was in crisis. So they wouldn't let me leave, but they couldn't do anything for me because they didn't have the staff, which again is like not their fault, not the staff's fault. Behavioral health has a bad name because we are underfunded, just like schools, just like police departments. It's like the most needed things in our world is not where the money's going. I don't really need Gucci shoes. I need an education and firefighters and mental health, but whatever. Sorry for that tangent. So anyway, I spend 4 or 5 hours, don't really get anything except for judgment, feeling more frustrated than ever. I just wasted my entire day. I go and talk to my dad, who is also in recovery, for 30 minutes, and he immediately identifies that I'm having marijuana withdrawal, which I never even, in all my years of studying substance abuse, had even heard of. And that's the kind of thing that a peer can offer you over a provider.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. I don't know if I have to say this, but I feel like I just want to be clear that I did have teachers throughout my life that were there for me. And it's not the specific teachers that were making me feel that way. It's the whole system.
The culture.
The culture and the whole, you know, just our whole school system is very messed up. And I think we all know that. But I just had to say, like, because I did have some really amazing teachers who did try and treat me with respect. But
well, and I know some really and I know some really amazing police officers. I grew up with, you know, one of the police officers in Carbondale I felt like was my only friend and ally. But I've also had police officers kind of treat me in that same way where mm-hmm. it's like, oh, you're just some drunk, promiscuous teenager. You're not going to amount to anything. Well, you know, you're not even worth our time. Mm-hmm. And when you're not even worth the police department's time or the judicial system's time, like, and coming from a place where, like, I didn't have really anyone supporting me, the few people that were trying to support me also struggle with their own problems with mental health and substance abuse. Or like my grandfather was a huge part of my life, but he doesn't live here. And so it's like, yeah, if you're getting that message from everyone around you, like, then yeah, of course you're going to believe that message too. I'm a mess up. I'm a screw up. I'm nothing but an addict, and I'm just going to die just like my mom. Yeah.
And another place where there's so much stigma and where so many, mostly women, get don't seek out help or treatment. Also, is when you've been sexually assaulted mm-hmm. and the shame and stigma that may come at you from a healthcare provider or from the police. And, you know, there was one time when I was 16 or 17 and I went to the hospital to report being assaulted, or I'm honestly, I don't know what happened. I was blacked out, and I don't know what happened, but my friends were all very freaked out when they found me. That was the time actually when I was choking, and I actually was, someone was carrying me into the house, freaked out, and accidentally dropped me. And when they dropped me, that's what knocked the puke out. And
oh,
and saved my life.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I didn't know what happened. And but my friends were like, let's go to the hospital. Like, they were worried, they were scared. And I didn't get help. I didn't get a rape kit done. I didn't get any of that done because, first of all, they needed to know what house I was at, and like, they needed to talk to an adult. And there wasn't any of that. There wasn't an adult for them to talk to. I couldn't give them the information of the place that I was at for, you know, whatever reasons. And she made me feel so bad. And finally, by the end of it, I just was like, you know what? Never mind. I'm not going to press charges. I'm not going to try and seek any help. And I just went on and...
Yeah.
It's so I just wanted to point that out because, like you said, there's so many different places where there's stigma. And when you're a drug addict, it's not just the addict that you're – it's not just the addiction that you're being stigmatized about. It's the mental health. It's the situations that you're putting yourself in. Mm. And then you know, and it's like I didn't – anyway. So
yeah,
I just want to put that out there.
I know that this is like not necessarily like the primary topic of Chemical World, but what I love about substance abuse work is how it intersects with so many other things that are really important to me, such as domestic violence, veterans affairs, incarcerated, prison reform, really judicial reform. And a lot of the social justice issues that I'm very passionate about, they're all connected. And something that I find really interesting is the history of the medicalization of women's health. And it's just another way that the patriarchy has, you know, really ran the show. And, you know, I've studied the medicalization of childbirth and just how it was really the way we do things right now in a hospital. And this is changing too a lot. There's a lot more options. But like that was designed for the comfort of the doctor, not the comfort of the woman. A lot of women don't like being super drugged up when they have their kids, but some women do. And, you know, again, I'm always talking about options and choices and the right to be your own advocate and agent of your healthcare. And, yeah, it's just, again, it's like not even like, so like a woman working in that field, she might not believe these things, but it's like hard to not be, for lack of a better word, brainwashed by the system that you work for, right? Because mm-hmm. especially if you've been doing it for a long time, you just get in the motions of talking about certain things a certain way. And I think we're all like stubborn and not always like, I mean, me, I'm very open because I definitely learn something new every day. I am not the master. Like this is such an such a deep subject, you know, but a lot of people are hesitant to take new information, especially when they've been doing something and it's been working. But of course, doing things the way it's been done is like the worst excuse to do anything. But, you know, it's just interesting how women's healthcare has been just dictated by what males perceive women need. And that's just not at all how it is. And with sexual assaults, it's really difficult because it's very traumatizing to go through that information. And it's definitely getting better, though. And I will say that River Bridge is an organization in Glenwood that I don't know if they were around when we were kids. Mm-hmm. But they are sexual assault for, I believe, people under 21. So they work mostly with children. But the people who work there are phenomenal. And they are so committed and so passionate about that work. And it is just such an amazing organization. And so, again, I can see this shift. And I'm just really honored to be a part of these changes and to be a part of people talking about change.
Me too. Like I said, I love being honest and I love hearing stories of people in recovery. I love hearing stories of people's struggles, any kind of sad story, I love hearing. And I guess it probably has a lot to do with not feeling alone in my sadness. And I do just have to say, like, personally, there's a lot of really great things going on in my life. And I still am sad a lot. And I think that I was listening to a book recently, No Happy Endings by Nora McInerney. And she mentions how there are so many feelings going on at once all of the time. And I think that to say that you either feel one way or you feel another is also another danger that we need to get away from. And we need to recognize that you can be happy and excited about what's going on in your life and excited about what's happening and still have that underlining sadness. So.
Yeah, and that's actually something that my therapists remind me about from time to time is like, you know, the goal shouldn't be to never be sad. Mm-hmm. And specifically with grief, like, I'm never going to have my best friend back. I'm never going to have my mom back. I'm never going to, you know, be able to see or talk to the countless people that I've lost. And so I'm always going to live with some amount of depression, and that's okay. But I can still get out of bed most mornings. And when I do have those days that are hard, I can tell myself, like, this is just today. And mm-hmm. tomorrow is going to be better. And it's okay. And it's natural to be sad. And something else I wanted to say was just, you know, I mentioned my therapist to a client of mine recently. And he was like, oh, you have a therapist? And I said, oh, yeah. And so now I, like, mention it all the time because, yeah, I would never ask somebody to do something that I was unwilling to do. I would never, you know, be here drinking, asking you to quit drinking. Mm-hmm. I would never be here just running wild with my anxiety saying you should probably see a therapist, right? Like, we need to model behaviors, and by talking about it, we can reduce that stigma.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I want to say thank you, Maggie, for doing this peer recovery work. I just think that, like we said in the last episode, both of us being in recovery together has really, that's helped me in an incredible amount. And also you starting this work and opening my eyes to different recovery models, because honestly, I thought I was the only one doing recovery the way that I was doing it. And I'm not, and we're all doing it differently, and we're all doing what works for us. And I want to just say to the people out there who maybe are worried about what they're doing, and if they're maybe doing certain substances too much, there's a way to get better and to feel better about what you're doing in life. And it doesn't have to be abstinence, and it doesn't have to be anything that you've seen before. Just try it out. Just try something out.
Yeah.
And reach out to a friend.
And everything's baby steps, you know, and you gotta, you know, celebrate those little moments. Like, I'm still smoking cigarettes because I couldn't. Some people do quit everything at once, and I definitely understand that mentality, but that was too hard for me, you know? So thinking, like, maybe once I've got 2 years under my belt, I'm seriously thinking about quitting smoking now. Anyway, that's not my point. My point is that, yeah, there's moderation management. There's marijuana maintenance. There's 100% abstinence. There's, you know, all sorts of ways of doing it. But I believe that the first step to recovery is taking your first drink or using your first substance, because you'll never find recovery if you're not abusing things. But, like, just because you're still using doesn't mean that you're not on your pathway to recovery. And Kenna and I were so, so lucky the way that our recovery serendipitously paralleled each other's. But, you know, because having friends in recovery is a huge step to entering recovery yourself. And if you feel like you don't have those kind of supportive friendships, well, you do now, and you can always reach out to Kenna and I.
That's right. And you can reach out to us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. And our next episode will be airing on Katie and Kay at 4:30 on December 14th.
And if you are interested in sharing your recovery story or experiences with substances or alcohol on Chemical World, please reach out to me, Maggie Seldine, at mseldine@mindspringshealth.org. You can give me a call at 970-531-5060. If you'd like to get involved, if you have any questions, if you need some peer support, or if you are a person in recovery interested in being a peer yourself, we need more people like you. So please reach out to me. I look forward to hearing from you. All right. So my fun fact of the day is another little piece of data from my hero, Dr. Rob Valick. And that is that 73% of people in treatment facilities for opioid use disorder started with someone else's pain prescription. So if you or someone else in your household has a pain prescription that they're no longer using, you can take it usually to local law enforcement or health agencies. If you're still using it, just think about having it in a safe place where other household members can't reach it. Because that is definitely a huge risk. Some people need their medications, but we want to make sure that they're being disposed of and stored safely and properly.
Thank you for listening to Katie and Kay and Chemical World.
And remember, you don't have to stay sober
to keep your community clean.
Living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl.